story runs, state has nearly $400 million in unspent funds. And then below that, we see a picture of a group of people on the Senate floor being greeted by another well-known politician. He is Senate Majority Leader Bob Duff, who's talking with workers from the Connecticut Department of Transportation on Monday on the Senate floor before being recognized for the work they did on quickly reopening I-95 in Norwalk after a gas tanker crash on Thursday. And there's a quote from Governor Lamont here, too, dealing with these workers. Too often in government, you have politicians who overpromise and underdeliver. Not the people standing behind me here. These guys overdelivered. And of course, he's referring to those DOT workers. Below that, we have a picture of a man and a woman sitting on a bench. The man is Evan Vickers, 30. He suffered third-degree burns to 75% of his body. 5 months later, Vickers is alive and getting better each day. Let us move on now to the front page of the New York Times, where above the fold and across four of the six columns, we have a picture of a young child who is surrounded by adults. Many of them have their cell phone cameras out taking a picture of her, and she is wrapped, at least her face and her head is completely wrapped in gauze bandages. She is Saja Bilad Junaid, 3, at Kennedy Airport on Sunday. She will be treated at a hospital in Dayton, Ohio, for third-degree burns on her face. And then below that, we have a picture of an individual in a gown in a very formal setting. It's a gala of some sort, where dressing is an art, is the caption. Zendaya showing off her Garden of Time-themed attire at the Met Gala. And the New York Times is encouraging people to look for more coverage at its website. Then over on the right, we have a small picture of an older Volkswagen van. It's filled with people and household possessions, and the caption tells us that these are Gazans who fled Rafah, who arrived Monday in Khan Yunis. Those are the photos on the front pages of the two morning newspapers from which we'll be reading. Let's go now to the lead story. And Kathy Danaher.
Israeli military orders 110,000 to leave Rafah. This by Vivek Shankar and Matthew Polk Big. Israeli warplanes pounded targets in the southern Gaza city of Rafah on Monday, as its military told about 110,000 people sheltering there to leave, heightening fears among Palestinians that Israel was inching closer to invading the city in defiance of international pressure. On Monday night, the Israeli military said it was, quote, conducting targeted strikes against Hamas terror targets in eastern Rafah, end quote. Earlier in the day, the military had dropped leaflets in eastern Rafah, ordering people to evacuate temporarily to what it described as a humanitarian zone, and said it would also notify people by text messages, phone calls, and broadcasts in Arabic. An Israeli military spokesman would not say if or when troops would enter the city, but described the evacuation as, quote, part of plans to dismantle Hamas, end quote, and to bring back hostages taken on October 7th. Thousands of people were leaving the city, according to the Palestine Red Crescent Society, which said on Monday that there had been, quote, escalating Israeli airstrikes, end quote, in areas east of Rafah. The extent of any casualties was not immediately clear. Israel's closest allies, including the United States, have been urging it not to mount a large ground operation in Rafah, saying it would take a heavy toll on civilians, more than a million of whom have crammed into the city to escape fighting elsewhere. But Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has repeatedly rejected those calls, saying Israel needs to defend itself and eliminate Hamas, which attacked Israel on October 7th. Hours after the evacuation order, President Biden spoke by phone with Mr. Netanyahu and, quote, reiterated his clear position on Rafah, end quote, according to a White House statement. The order came a day after officials said that months of talks over a ceasefire and the release of hostages had hit an impasse, with Israel and Hamas still sharply at odds over the duration of any truce. Hamas wants a permanent ceasefire, while Mr. Netanyahu has expressed openness to only a temporary halt in the fighting and has said Israel would invade Rafah with or without an agreement. Salama Maruf, the head of the Hamas-run Gaza government media office, said in a statement on Monday that the evacuation order showed that Israel, quote, went into truce negotiations deceptively without abandoning the idea of a broad aggression against Rafah, end quote. He said the announcement was a, quote, a real test of the seriousness, end quote, of the countries that had warned against an invasion of the city. On Sunday, Mr. Netanyahu repeated his promise to destroy Hamas, vowing in English in a speech marking Israel's Holocaust Remembrance Day that Israel, quote, will defeat our genocidal enemies, end quote.
Now this headline from the World and Nation pages of the Hartford Courant. Trump fined again over gag order. Judge admonishes that new violations could get jail time. This by Michael R. Sisak, Jennifer Peltz, and Eric Tucker of the Associated Press. The judge presiding over former President Donald Trump's hush money trial fined him $1,000 on Monday, and, in his sternest warning yet, said future gag order violations could send him to jail, while jurors heard detailed testimony for the first time about the financial reimbursements at the center of the case. The testimony from Jeffrey McConney, the former Trump Organization controller, provided a mechanical but vital recitation of how the company reimbursed payments meant to suppress embarrassing stories from surfacing during the 2016 presidential campaign, and then logged them as legal expenses in a manner that Manhattan prosecutors said broke the law. At the center of the testimony and the case itself is a $130,000 payment from Trump attorney and personal fixer Michael Cohen to porn performer Stormy Daniels to stifle her claims of an extramarital sexual encounter with Trump a decade earlier. The 34 felony counts of falsifying business records accused Trump of labeling the money paid to Cohen in his company's records as legal fees. Prosecutors contend that by paying him income and giving him extra to account for taxes, the Trump executives were able to conceal the reimbursement. McConney and another witness testified that the reimbursement checks were drawn from Trump's personal account. Yet even as jurors witnessed the checks and other documentary evidence, prosecutors did not elicit testimony Monday showing that Trump himself dictated that the payments would be logged as legal expenses, a designation that prosecutors contend was intentionally deceptive. McConney acknowledged during the cross-examination that Trump never asked him to log the reimbursements as legal expenses or discussed the matter with him at all. And another witness, Deborah Tarasoff, a Trump Organization accounts payable supervisor, said under questioning that she did not get permission to cut the checks in question from Trump himself. Quote, "You never had any reason to believe that President Trump was hiding anything or anything like that?" unquote, asked Trump attorney Todd Blanche. "Correct," she replied. The testimony followed a stern warning from Judge Juan Merchant that additional violations of a gag order barring Trump from inflammatory out-of-court comments about witnesses, jurors, and others closely connected to the case could result in jail time. The $1,000 fine imposed Monday marks the second time since the trial began last month that Trump has been sanctioned for violating the gag order. He was fined $9,000 last week, $1,000 for each of nine violations. Quote, "It appears that the $1,000 fines are not serving as a deterrent. Therefore, going forward, this court will have to consider a jail sanction," unquote, Merchant said before jurors were brought into the courtroom. Trump's statements, the judge added, quote, "threaten to interfere with the fair administration of justice and constitute a direct attack on the rule of law. I cannot allow that to continue."
And from the New York Times, Russia plans drill for battlefield nuclear strike, this by Anton Troyanovsky. Russia said on Monday that it would hold military exercises with troops based near Ukraine to practice for the possible use of battlefield nuclear weapons, a provocative warning aimed at discouraging the West from deepening its support for Ukraine. These weapons, often referred to as tactical, are designed for battlefield use and have smaller warheads than the strategic nuclear weapons meant to target cities. Russia's defense ministry said that President Vladimir V. Putin had ordered an exercise for missile, aviation, and naval personnel to, quote, increase the readiness of non-strategic nuclear forces to carry out combat missions, end quote. The announcement of the exercise was Russia's most explicit warning in its more than two-year invasion of Ukraine that it could use tactical nuclear weapons there. The Kremlin said it came in response to comments by two European leaders that raised the prospect of more direct Western intervention in the war. The exercise, the defense ministry said, would involve forces of the Southern Military District, an area that covers Russian-occupied Ukraine and part of Russia's border region with Ukraine. It said the exercises would take place, quote, in the near future, end quote. The order ratchets up tensions with the West at the start of a week of extensive publicity for Mr. Putin. His inauguration, scheduled for Tuesday, followed on Thursday by the annual Victory Day celebration, which commemorates Soviet victory in World War II. It also coincided with a visit to Europe by President Xi Jinping of China, which has pledged a, quote, no limits, end quote, alliance with Russia. China has provided support to Russia's military industry, U.S. officials say, despite persistent lobbying from the West that it refrain from aiding Russia's war effort. Asked by Mr. Putin's order on Monday, John F. Kirby, a White House national security spokesman, said, quote, it's just reckless and irresponsible for a leader of a major nuclear armed power to be saber-rattling the way that he is with respect to potential use of nuclear weapons, end quote. Western officials have long worried that Russia would deploy tactical nuclear weapons, especially if it faced serious setbacks on the battlefield. But Mr. Putin denied as recently as March that he had ever considered it, even as he regularly reminds the world of Russia's vast nuclear arsenal as a way of keeping in check the West's military support for Ukraine. On Monday, however, Russian officials claimed that warnings about the possibility of more direct Western involvement in the war had changed the situation. The Defense Ministry said the exercise would be held, quote, to unconditionally ensure the territorial integrity and sovereignty of the Russian state, in response to provocative statements and threats of individual Western officials against the Russian Federation, end quote.
Back to the Hartford Current for this headline. Columbia University calls off Maine commencement. This by Karen Matthews of the Associated Press. Columbia University canceled its large university-wide commencement ceremony Monday, following weeks of pro-Palestinian demonstrations that have roiled its campus and others across the U.S., but students will still be able to celebrate at a series of smaller school-based ceremonies this week and next. The decision comes as universities wrangle with how to handle commencements. Another campus shaken by protests, Emory University, announced Monday that it would move its commencement from its Atlanta campus to a suburban arena. But others, including the University of Michigan, Indiana University, and Northeastern, have pulled off ceremonies with few disruptions. Columbia's decision to cancel its main ceremonies, scheduled for May 15th, saves its president, Manush Shifik, from having to deliver a commencement address in the same part of campus where police dismantled a protest encampment last week, noting that the past few weeks have been, quote, incredibly difficult, unquote. The school in Upper Manhattan said that it made the decision after discussions with students, quote, our students emphasized that these smaller-scale, school-based celebrations are most meaningful to them and their families, unquote, officials said. Quoting again, they are eager to cross the stage to applause and family pride and hear from their school's invited guest speakers, unquote. Most of the ceremonies that had been scheduled for the South Lawn of the main campus, where encampments were taken down last week, will take place about 5 miles north at Columbia's sports complex, officials said. Columbia had already canceled in-person classes. More than 200 pro-Palestinian demonstrators who had camped out or occupied an academic building were arrested in recent weeks. The University of California, Los Angeles alerted students Monday that all classes were moving online because of ongoing disruptions since a pro-Palestinian encampment was dismantled last week. Also Monday, police cleared a pro-Palestinian encampment at the University of California, San Diego, and arrested more than 64 people, San Diego Union-Tribune reported.
From the New York Times, genetics causes up to 20% of Alzheimer's cases, study suggests, this by Pam Bellick. Scientists are proposing a new way of understanding the genetics of Alzheimer's that would mean that up to a fifth of patients would be considered to have a genetically caused form of the disease. Currently, the vast majority of Alzheimer's cases do not have a clearly identified cause. The new designation, proposed in a study published Monday, could broaden the scope of efforts to develop treatments, including gene therapy, and affect the design of clinical trials. It could also mean that hundreds of thousands of people in the United States alone could, if they chose, receive a diagnosis of Alzheimer's before developing any symptoms of cognitive decline, although there currently are no treatments for people at that stage. The new classification would make this type of Alzheimer's one of the most common genetic disorders in the world, medical experts said. Quote, "This reconceptualization that we're proposing affects not a small minority of people," end quote, said Dr. Juan Fortier, an author of the study and the director of the Sant Pau Memory Unit in Barcelona, Spain. Quote, "Sometimes we say that we don't know the cause of Alzheimer's disease," end quote. But he said, this would mean that about 15 to 20% of cases can be tracked back to a cause, and the cause is in the genes, end quote. The idea involves a gene variant called AP0E4. Scientists have long known that inheriting one copy of the variant increases the risk of developing Alzheimer's, and that people with two copies inherited from each parent have vastly increased risk. The new study, published in the Journal of Nature Medicine, analyzed data from over 500 people with two copies of APOE4, a significantly larger pool than in previous studies. The researchers found that almost all of those patients developed the biological pathology of Alzheimer's, and the authors say that two copies of APOE4 should now be considered a cause of Alzheimer's, not simply a risk factor. The patients also developed Alzheimer's pathology relatively young, the study found. By age 55, over 95% had biological markers associated with a disease. By 65, almost all had abnormal levels of a protein called amyloid that forms plaques in the brain, a hallmark of Alzheimer's.
Now from the New York Times, the National Weather Forecast. A cold front will spread thunderstorms from Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois to northern Arkansas. Farther west, a storm over the northern Rockies will bring rain and high-elevation snow. Spotty showers could develop in the northwest. That's a brief summation of the national forecast. Now the local weather.
Join us Saturdays at 5:30 p.m. and Sundays at 2:30 p.m. for the Reader's Digest. I'm Chris.
The forecast for tonight is partly cloudy with a low around 53. Tomorrow, Wednesday, there's a chance of showers and thunderstorms. It'll be mostly cloudy, with a high near 71. And tomorrow night, there's a chance of showers, mostly cloudy, with a low around 53. Thursday, there's a chance of rain. It'll be mostly cloudy, with a high near 69. And Thursday night, there's a chance of rain. It'll be cloudy, with a low around 48. Friday, there's a chance of rain, mostly cloudy, with a high near 58. And Friday night, a chance of rain, mostly cloudy, with a low around 45. Have a good evening. Thank you for listening to Chris.
We turn our attention now to the business section of the New York Times as the front pages continue. Health of Social Security and Medicare improves is the headline, this article by Alan Rappaport and Margot Sanger-Katz. The financial health of Social Security and Medicare, two of the nation's most crucial safety net programs, improved this year as a stronger-than-expected economy attracted more workers to the labor market. But the overall financial outlook of the popular programs remained grim. Annual reports released on Monday by trustees of the old age and retirement programs showed that both still faced long-term shortfalls that could ultimately result in reduced retirement and Medicaid benefits. The reports showed that the Social Security and Disability Insurance programs, if combined, would not have enough money to pay off all of their obligations in 2035. Medicare will be unable to pay all of its hospital bills starting in 2036. About 70 million people receive Social Security benefits, and more than 66 million participate in Medicare. The fate of the popular programs continues to be a contentious political issue, one that is expected to intensify as the November presidential election draws near. President Biden has pledged to block any cuts to Social Security and Medicare and has called for shoring up the programs with higher taxes on the rich. Former President Donald J. Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee, suggested this year that he was open to scaling back the programs when he said there was a, quote, lot you can do in terms of entitlements, in terms of cutting, unquote. He later walked back those comments and pledged to protect the programs. In a statement on Monday, Mr. Biden highlighted Republican proposals that would cut Social Security. Among the cuts would be raising the retirement age to qualify for benefits. He promised that he would be the bulwark against such policies. Quote, I will always fight for American seniors and prevent Republicans from cutting Social Security and Medicare, unquote, Mr. Biden said. Biden administration officials said the upgraded outlook for the programs was a sign that Mr. Biden's economic agenda was working and insisted that they would resist any proposed cuts. Quote, seniors spent a lifetime working to earn the benefits they receive, and the Biden-Harris administration will continue to oppose cuts to either program, unquote, Treasury Secretary Janet L. Yellen said in a statement. Quote, we are committed to steps that would protect and strengthen these programs that Americans rely on for a secure retirement, unquote. Martin O'Malley, the Commissioner of Social Security, said that as long as Americans continued to work, the retirement program would be able to keep paying benefits, and he called on Congress to provide more money for the trust fund to ensure its long-term solvency.
Tensions rise in Silicon Valley over sales of startup stocks. The market for shares of hot startups like SpaceX and Stripe is projected to reach a record $64 billion this year. This by Aaron Griffith. Sohail Prasad, an entrepreneur, launched a fund in March called the Destiny Tech 100. The fund owns shares in hot tech startups like the payments firm Stripe, the rocket maker SpaceX, and the artificial intelligence company OpenAI. Few people get the chance to invest in these privately held companies since their shares are not openly traded. Mr. Prasad's intention with Destiny was to let the rest of the world get a piece of them through his fund. But soon after Destiny debuted, two tech startups, Stripe and Plaid, a banking service, said the fund did not legally own their shares. A competitor criticized Destiny as, quote, too good to be true, end quote. Robinhood, the stock trading app, stopped letting investors buy into the fund, saying it had been added to its app by mistake. Mr. Prasad was not surprised by the uproar. It was a sign of, quote, a true cultural movement in which DXYZ is at the forefront, end quote, he said, referring to Destiny by its ticker symbol. Tensions over the shadowy and often enigmatic market of private company stocks have reached a boiling point, just as the buying and selling of such shares has grown bigger than ever. At its center is an age-old debate. Should everyone have access to the riches and risks of investing in Silicon Valley startups? The market for private company stocks, also known as the secondary market, is on track to hit a record $64 billion this year, up 40% from last year, according to Sakra, a research firm founded on private investments.
Up to others to build EV stations is our next headline from the New York Times business section, this article by Jack Ewing and Ivan Penn. Elon Musk, the chief executive of Tesla, blindsided competitors, suppliers, and his own employees last week by reversing course on his aggressive push to build electric vehicle chargers in the United States, a major priority of the Biden administration. Mr. Musk's decision to lay off the 500-member team responsible for installing charging stations and to sharply slow investment in new stations baffled the industry and raised doubts about whether the number of public chargers would grow fast enough to keep pace with the sale of battery-powered cars. It put the onus on other charging companies, raising questions about whether they can build fast enough to address a shortage that appears to be discouraging some people from buying electric cars. As the owner of the largest charging network in the United States, Tesla has a powerful effect on people's views of electric cars. Quote, "There is certainly a psychological component," unquote, said Robert Zabers, a senior partner at Roland Berger, a consulting firm. Quote, "Availability and reliability are critical to overall EV adoption," unquote. Tesla's change of direction only days after it had told shareholders in a securities filing that it would rapidly expand its charging network, which it calls Supercharger, is likely to delay construction of fast chargers, which are concentrated along the two coasts and in parts of Texas. Wildflower, a New York real estate developer, was on the verge of signing a lease with Tesla to build a charging center near the intersections of Interstates 278 and 495 in Queens. Then Adam Gordon, the firm's managing partner, got a text message from the Tesla executive he had been working with. Quote, "Hey, I was fired at 4 a.m. and my boss was fired too," unquote, the Tesla manager said, according to Mr. Gordon. Quoting again, "That was the only communication we got from Tesla," unquote, he added.
China is buying gold like there's no tomorrow. This by Daisuke Wakabayashi and Claire Fu. As gold surged this year to its highest price ever, Zena Lin joined the frenzy by making monthly purchases of gold beans, pebble-like morsels of the precious metal. For Ms. Lin, a 25-year-old administrative worker in southern China, the $80 beans, small enough to rest on a fingertip and weighing about 1/30th of an ounce, were an affordable way to buy into the gold excitement without splurging for jewelry, gold bars, or coins. She had dabbled with investing in stocks in the past, but said buying gold, especially in this fun way, inspired her to continue investing. Quote, "I'm still working hard to save more," end quote, Ms. Lin said. Often considered a safe investment during times of geopolitical and economic turmoil, gold has soared in price in response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the war in Gaza. But gold's climb to highs above $2,400 an ounce has proved more resilient and lasted longer because of China. Chinese consumers have flocked to gold as their confidence in traditional investments has faltered. And we'll return after these messages.
Many Americans are clearly seeing their way to help those who save the nation, but have lost their sight. There are about 120,000 blinded veterans in America today, and that number grows by 5,000 a year as veterans return from current conflicts without their precious eyesight, and as veterans of other eras lose their vision to age-related eye diseases. They can all find help and hope through an organization founded in 1945, the Blinded Veterans Association. Its services are free to all veterans, not just members. Its field representatives are blinded veterans themselves, who counsel other blinded veterans and their families. They also act as role models and link veterans with services, rehabilitation training, jobs, and other benefits. In addition, blinded veteran volunteers work out of VA medical centers, providing counseling and information, and demonstrating how to use equipment designed for the blind. To learn how BVA can help you or how you can help it, call 1-800-669-7079 or visit www.bva.org.
State and local news and stories from the Hartford Current will now be our exclusive focus as the front pages continue. And we'll start on the front page. At the very top for this headline, state has nearly $400 million unspent funds. Lawmakers planning to use federal money for Yukon towns. This by Christopher Keating. After weeks of behind-the-scenes negotiations, state lawmakers were expected to vote Monday night on reallocating hundreds of millions of dollars in federal funds for high-priority fiscal items. The four largest areas of funding are public higher education, children's mental health, municipal aid, and $50 million for nonprofits that provide state services through contracts that traditionally cost less than those delivered by state employees. The total allocation is $360 million, but that could be boosted to $400 million if the size of the state budget surplus becomes better than expected as of October 1st. While voting on other bills in an all-day marathon, the State House of Representatives had not yet started debating the spending measure as of 5 p.m. Monday. Lawmakers are racing toward a deadline of midnight Wednesday for the adjournment of the 2024 regular session. The package includes more than $115 million for the University of Connecticut, including $68 million for temporary support for UConn and $48 million for temporary support for the UConn Health Center in Farmington, according to a copy of the bill that was released early Monday morning. The 350-page bill also calls for $128.8 million for the Connecticut State University system, which has been lobbying heavily for months for more funding. In a highly unusual move, the legislature is not reopening the second year of the two-year state budget that provides $26 billion to run the state in the fiscal year that starts on July 1st. Instead, they will be reallocating unspent federal funds that the state received during the coronavirus pandemic from the American Rescue Plan Act, known in the common parlance as ARPA. Lawmakers are planning to create a new, quote, stabilization support and ARPA replacement fund, unquote, that would be held by the state treasurer, separate from other funds. Regarding children, the spending plan includes $18.8 million for care for kids, child care for low and moderate income families, $10 million for children's behavioral health, and $7 million for urgent crisis centers. While Democrats said that they were simply reallocating unspent federal funds, Republicans had a sharply different view. House Republican leader Vincent Candelora of North Branford said it is an easy no vote for him because of his deep concerns about the fiscal plans and concerns that they might violate the state's mandated spending cap. Democrats, though, say the federal spending is outside the cap. Quote, I'm questioning the mental gymnastics, it seems, that the Democrats have gone through to try to convince the state of Connecticut that what they are doing today is not a budget, unquote, Candelora told Capitol reporters. Quoting again, we received the document at 4:30 a.m. this morning. After going through it, we can clearly see some new appropriations and line items. We see some money defunded and reappropriated to other priorities. With all that, that is a budgetary action, which under our Constitution requires us to make sure that it's a balanced budget. They are lying to themselves that they are not doing a budget. In fact, they are doing a budget, unquote. Besides the traditional municipal aid that includes more than $2 billion annually for local schools, the package includes additional municipal aid of $12 million for Danbury, $7 million for Bridgeport, $5.5 million for Waterbury, $5 million for Norwalk, $4 million for New Britain, $2 million for Stamford, and $1.5 million for New Haven.
Man gets prison for violent assault. Victim credits Newington police, wants the story shared. This by Taylor Hartz. Angelica Moore, a social worker from Cape Cod, said she never expected to fall into a relationship with a domestic abuser. she figured she'd be able to spot the signs, given her line of work. And when a charming personal trainer at her gym approached her, the warning bells did not go off, at least at first. But when Moore headed to Connecticut one weekend in April 2022 for her daughter's dance competition and brought Brett Geddes along, things took a violent turn in a Newington hotel room. After 2 years of healing and a conviction, Moore and a Newington Police Department detective who stuck by her side are speaking out to share her story of survival and the importance of holding domestic violence abusers accountable in the justice system. Moore said she finally feels ready to empower and caution other women. Quote, I have waited over 2 years to do this as I wanted to reach the end of this case I fought for, end quote, she told the Hartford Courant just days after Geddes was sentenced to prison for assaulting her. Quote, I work in a setting where being the voice for others is very important to my identity, and it's never too late for others to speak up for unspeakable acts done to them, end quote. The violent assault. On April 24th, a Connecticut judge ruled that 33-year-old Geddes will spend 5 years behind bars for the sexual assault and strangulation of Moore. Geddes, from Cape Cod, appeared virtually in New Britain Superior Court and was sentenced to 15 years in prison, suspended after he serves 5 years behind bars, 10 years of probation, records show. Geddes had pleaded guilty to first-degree sexual assault and second-degree strangulation or suffocation and is being held at the Cheshire Correctional Institution, Department of Correction records show. The charges stem from a violent assault that left Moore badly injured. According to a warrant affidavit for Geddes' arrest, he has a history of domestic violence in Massachusetts and at the time of Moore's assault was under an active protective order for another woman.
Remaining on the front page of the Hartford Courant, officials lauded quick work of crews to reopen I-95. Rebuilding of overpass expected to take a year. This by Justin Musinski. A bridge demolished in the wake of a fiery crash that kept Interstate 95 in Norwalk shut down for days is expected to take about a year to rebuild. There is no firm timeline as to when construction on the Fairfield overpass will begin, as engineers are still working on a preliminary design that state officials are hoping will be done in the next few weeks, Connecticut Department of Transportation Commissioner Garrett Ucellito said at a news conference on Monday. Ucellito was joined by Governor Ned Lamont, Norwalk Mayor Harry Rilling, and U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal outside a local fire department adjacent to the portion of the interstate that was closed for days following a crash involving a fuel tanker and two other vehicles last Thursday. Officials applauded the work of DOT and demolition crews that led to I-95 reopening Sunday morning, a full day ahead of schedule. Quote, too often in government you have politicians who overpromise and underdeliver, unquote, Lamont said, reflecting on the smooth-running traffic compared to what he said was, quote, hell getting here, unquote, just under 80 hours earlier. Quote, not the people standing behind me here, these guys overdelivered, unquote. I-95 was shut down in both directions on Thursday at around 5:30 a.m. when a passenger car was involved in a crash with a tractor-trailer and a tanker carrying 8,500 gallons of fuel. The crash led to a massive fire to the tanker and surrounding area as about half of the tanker's load spilled and went up in flames. The fire caused compromising damage to the overpass that could not be repaired. The highway was jammed with traffic in the area in the following days as the interstate was shut down for all on Thursday and Friday as crews demolished the overpass and began removing the rubble ahead of the road needing to be repaved. The northbound side of I-95 reopened Saturday night, and the southbound lanes soon followed the next morning after Lamont had initially said officials were hoping to have the highway fully operational by the Monday morning commute.
Burn victim triumphs by surviving. Man who didn't have much of a chance, getting better daily. This by Sean Krofsik. Diana Vickers was expecting to sing Christmas carols in a choir in December, but instead she was singing to her son, Evan, while he was on life support fighting for his life at the Connecticut Burn Center at Bridgeport Hospital. She never left his side. Quote, "I sang at the foot of his bed," Vickers said. "I was hoping he could hear me if I was singing," end quote. It wasn't the holiday season the Vickers were hoping for, but it eventually had a happy ending. Evan Vickers, 30, suffered third-degree burns up to 75% of his body. But 5 months later, Vickers is alive and getting better each day. Vickers spent 110 days at Bridgeport Hospital fighting for his life and did 28 days of inpatient care at Gaylord Specialty Healthcare, including physical and occupational therapy. He was discharged this past Monday. He recently had a reunion with many of his therapists, nurses, and doctors at Gaylord, again with him, his mom by his side. Hugs were plentiful for Evan. Many of his nurses from Bridgeport made him a neck compression device that was signed by them. Diana Vickers couldn't hold in the joy, thanking them all for nursing her son back to health. Quote, "This is a wonderful ending to the story," Diana Vickers said, "a pivotal life-saving choice," end quote. The story had not promised such an ending. In late December, Evan was burning some of his grandmother's old paperwork in the backyard of the family's four-acre property in Columbia. He was prepared with a bucket of water and a hose nearby the fire pit. As he had lit the final bag of paperwork, he threw a small log into the fire pit. He was unaware the wood had rotted and was laden with sap. Quote, "The sap got on my pants and then all over my clothing and caught fire," Evan Vickers said. "I tried to stop, drop, and roll, but it didn't work. I got up, and lucky, I was right next to the lake, and I just jumped in," end quote. A neighbor called 911 and stayed with the younger Vickers until emergency services arrived. LifeStar arrived shortly after and brought him to the Connecticut Burn Center.
Dentist to pay $500,000 to settle kickback allegations. Two accused of paying to recruit patients for Medicaid work. This by Justin Musinski. Two Connecticut dentists have agreed to pay nearly $500,000 to resolve allegations that they paid kickbacks to someone who recruited Medicaid patients and referred them to their offices in New Britain and Waterbury. The reimbursement is part of a civil agreement Bohan Choi and Mishong Sun entered into with the state and federal government after it was alleged that the pair and their dental practice, C&S Family Dental, violated the False Claims Acts. The U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Connecticut and Connecticut Attorney General William Tong said Monday. According to federal officials, Choi and Sun were both licensed to practice dentistry in Connecticut, and their practices, C&S Dental, or I should say Family Dental, in New Britain and Waterbury, are enrolled as dental providers in the Connecticut Medical Assistance Program, which includes the state's Medicaid program. Officials said Choi and Son submitted claims to the Medical Assistance Program, quote, related to dental services rendered to Connecticut Medicaid patients referred to C&S New Britain and C&S Waterbury by third-party patient recruiting company, unquote, between April 2018 and January 2020. Authorities said the pair paid a recruiter $110 for each Medicaid patient referred to them for, quote, services over and above routine preventive care such as dental cleanings and exams, and submitted claims for dental services rendered to those patients. And we'll continue after this message.
Hi, I'm Tricia Beattie, a Chris Radio volunteer. If you need a ride to the store, a doctor's appointment, your job, or just to visit a friend, call Nutmeg Senior Rides. Nutmeg Senior Rides offers 24-hour service every day of the year to seniors and adults with visual impairment in Bloomfield, East Granby, East Windsor, Enfield, Granby, Summers, South Windsor, Suffield, Windsor, and Windsor Locks. This alternative transportation program uses a combination of volunteer and paid drivers who provide rides in private vehicles. There is no restriction on the purpose of a ride, and help is offered to carry packages, fold walkers, and open doors. That's why many feel that using Nutmeg Senior Rides is like riding with a friend. For more information, log on to nutmegseniorrides.org or call Margaret at 860-758-7833. That's 860-758-7833.
The Front Pages continues now with more local news and this article in The Current, which was supplied by Luke Feeney of the Connecticut Mirror. Protections for airline passengers to take off. Under new rules, state AG's office will handle complaints from Connecticut travelers. Airline passengers whose flights experience long delays will be able to claim refunds under new rules set by the Biden administration. The rule changes will also allow state attorneys general to investigate passenger complaints and will require extra fees to be stated clearly before tickets are purchased, changes that Attorney General William Tong said are an important step to being able to protect Connecticut travelers. In April, U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg announced the Airline Passenger Protection Partnership, a bipartisan agreement with 18 state airlines and ticket agents and hold them accountable when they violate aviation consumer protection laws. Quote, "We now have an agreement where we step in the shoes of the Department of Transportation and can investigate complaints about airlines from Connecticut travelers," unquote, Tong said. Quoting again, "Now when we call, they cannot say, 'Sorry, we can't talk to you, you're preempted,'" unquote. The goal of the partnership is to ensure that state attorneys general and the DOT's Office of Aviation Consumer Protection are closely collaborating on complaints involving unfair or deceptive practices by airlines. Tong also announced the creation of a new website for Connecticut flyers to file a complaint to the attorney general. Quote, "The status quo is not going to fly anymore," unquote, said U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat of Connecticut, at a press conference with Tong on April 29th. Major airlines have opposed the changes, arguing that consumer satisfaction is higher than it has ever been and citing the record numbers of airline passengers combined with lower fares. Before the rule changes, Congress enjoyed overwhelming jurisdiction over the regulation of airlines. Lawyers representing national airlines have long argued that the Federal Aviation Act of 1958 was intended to constrain the ability of states to pursue airline complaints from their residents.
Double murder case goes to jury. Man faces multiple charges in fatal 2016 shooting that left two dead in Hartford's North End. This by Taylor Hartz. The trial of Brandon Lettman on two murder charges is now in the hands of the jury, nearly 8 years after two people were gunned down in Hartford's North End. A 12-person jury was sent into the deliberation room about 4:30 p.m. Monday after attorneys for both sides gave their closing arguments at the end of the trial. Taking another step toward possible closure for the families of 19-year-old Cameron Mounds and 21-year-old Ashley Spence. Mounds' uncle, Lawrence Mounds Sr., said he started the final day of the trial by shaking hands and giving hugs to Lettman's loved ones, reaching across the courtroom aisle to extend forgiveness. Quote, "After this is over, we still have to go out in the world. We might run into each other in the grocery store," end quote, he said, wearing a City of Hartford sweatshirt in support of his hometown. Quote, "It's coming down to the finish line, and when we all walk out of here, guilty or not guilty, there's no bad blood," end quote. Lettman, a 33-year-old convicted felon from New Britain, is facing multiple charges, including murder and tampering with witnesses in connection with the death of Mounds and Spence on a summer night in 2016. The cases were turned over to the Cold Case Court in 2019, the same year Lettman was charged in connection with their slayings. Since the day of his arrest, Mounds said, the family has been getting closer and closer to closing the chapter of grief and pain, and he wants to make sure that it isn't reopened, whatever the verdict is. Mounds said he sees the trial as an opportunity for closure and a chance to break generational cycles of trauma and violence. Quote, "There shouldn't be what they call generational curses stemming from his nephew's death," he said. Somewhere along the line, it has to be broken, so I'm going to break it for that side of my family, end quote. Dozens of Mounds and Spence's loved ones packed the courtroom on Monday, wiping tears from their eyes, passing around boxes of tissues, and reaching out to comfort one another as Robin Krawczyk, Senior Assistant State's Attorney, and John Fahey, Supervisory Assistant State's Attorney and Head of the Cold Case Unit at the Office of the Chief State's Attorney, delivered their closing arguments.
Trampoline park proposed at shuttered supermarket. Apartments also eyed for East Hartford's Silver Lane. This by Don Stakem. East Hartford's long-range plan for revitalizing the Silver Lane corridor may be getting a boost from developer Nam Hu 351, which wants to build a three-story apartment building on a vacant tract near Rentschler Field. Farther east, another developer is proposing to convert part of the former Stop and Shop into a trampoline park. If the town approves those plans, they'd become the latest signs of progress along East Hartford's once-thriving commercial and entertainment corridor. Silver Lane began falling out of favor with shoppers and businesses in the 1970s, though, and gradually devolved into a dreary line of failing shops, empty storefronts, and trash-strewn vacant lots. A turnaround began several years ago, though, when Brian Zellman and Avner Krohn announced an ambitious plan to turn the empty Showcase Cinemas site into about 400 market-rate apartments. The town has since spearheaded a redevelopment of the shabby Silver Lane Plaza, and National Development has constructed two mega warehouses near the western end of Silver Lane that are expected to create 1,000 jobs. Part of the East Hartford's long-range plan to restore Silver Lane banks on smaller-scale, less splashy projects and infill development between successful businesses along the route. Municipal Development Director Eileen Buckeit said Nam Hu 351's apartment project would be a significant boost. Nam Hu 351 LLC proposes a three-story building at 351 Silver Lane with about 3,400 square feet of ground floor retail space for a store or quick-service restaurant. The project would include 20 one-bedroom apartments, 5 studios, and 10 two-bedroom apartments.
Iconic nightclub hoping for a comeback. After assault, Russian lady reopens with new name, image. This by Stephen Underwood. Iconic nightclub and bar, The Russian Lady, has reopened with a new name, new owner, and a new image as part of a rebranding to welcome back customers after being closed since late last year. Now simply called The Lady, the nightclub offers cocktails, music, and events, much like the former venue. The business held a grand opening on Friday evening. The beleaguered former nightclub voluntarily closed its doors back in November after a video circulated on social media showing a violent assault between a patron and security guards. The former nightclub was facing a lawsuit over the incident. After a brief reopening, the venue closed for good after a shooting occurred outside in December. But for new owner Jonathan Hagenhugen of South Windsor, it's all in the past. Hagenhugen, who has extensive experience in the entertainment industry, previously served as the Russian Lady's general manager and director of operations at FYC Entertainment, the former owner of the venue. Quote, I had great memories of when it was the Russian Lady, so I wanted to pay homage to the former name, Hagenhugen said. Continuing, the Russian Lady was in Hartford for nearly 50 years, so I didn't want to completely change it, but it's also different as well, end quote. The iconic venue first opened its doors on Ann Street back in 1976, before the street was renamed Ann Ucello for the city's first female mayor. Hagenhugen's company, JHC Entertainment LLC, took ownership of the business back in January. Since then, the bar underwent extensive renovations, including a new stage, lights, and the sound system. The iconic woodwork and antiques that came to define the former nightclub are still there, blending the past with the present. Quote, it still has that classic feel, but with all modern amenities, end quote, Hagenhugen said. Continuing, even more trivial stuff like a new air conditioner and a new furnace were installed. Everything works great and is brand new, end quote. The lottery for Monday, May 6th. Play 3-day, 907, wild ball 4. Play 4-day, 7025, wild ball 6. The late lotto numbers were not drawn in time for this edition. For results, please visit current.com/lottery. Sunday's late numbers. Play 3 night, 893, wild ball 0. Play 4 night, 3085, wild ball 1. Cash 5, 4, 10, 16, 21, 35. Lucky for life, 1, 6, 10, 16, 27, lucky ball 8. Tonight's estimated lotto jackpot, $2.6 million. Tonight's estimated Mega Millions jackpot, $306 million.
It's time now for Today in History, and we'll start by reminding ourselves that this is Tuesday, May 7th, the 128th day of 2024. There are 238 days left in the year. Today's highlight in history occurred on May 7th of 1945. Nazi Germany on that date signed an unconditional surrender at Allied headquarters in Reims, France, ending its role in World War II. Also on this date, in 1889, the John Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore opened its doors. In 1915, a German U-boat torpedoed and sank the British liner RMS Lusitania off the southern coast of Ireland, killing 1,198 people, including 128 Americans, out of the nearly 2,000 on board. In 1928, the minimum voting age for British women was lowered from 30 to 21, the same age as men. In 1939, Germany and Italy announced a military and political alliance known as the Rome-Berlin Axis. In 1941, Glenn Miller and his orchestra recorded Chattanooga Choo Choo for RCA Victor. In 1954, the 55-day Battle of Dien Bien Phu in Vietnam ended with Vietnamese insurgents overrunning French forces. In 1963, the United States launched the Telstar 2 communications satellite. And in 1975, President Gerald R. Ford formally declared an end to the Vietnam era in Ho Chi Minh City, formerly Saigon. The Viet Cong celebrated the takeover. And that's all for this edition of the Front Pages. We've been reading from today's Hartford Current and New York Times. Your readers have been Kathy Danaher. I'm Jim McPherson. If you missed any part of the program, it is repeated this evening at 6 and 11, and it's available anytime on our telephone reader service and on demand at our website, chrisradio.org. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
You're listening to Chris, celebrating 40 years as Connecticut's talking newsstand for the blind and print challenged.
Welcome to the Shopper's Guide. For the next 30 minutes, we'll take a look at the most recent sales flyers from various stores. Due to time limitations, we won't be able to read every sale item, but we'll do our best to feature a good selection from each department or product category to help you find the best values. Now, here's today's Shopper's Guide on Chris.
Hi, everyone. On today's Shopper's Guide, we'll open up the sales flyer from Stop and Shop, and we'll log on to the website at Stu Leonard's and see what they've posted for the week. We'll begin with Stop and Shop. Prices good through the 9th of May. Front page, in celebration of Cinco de Mayo. They've got some digital coupons. Here's one for 80% lean ground beef at $2.99 a pound with the Stop and Shop digital coupon. There's one for Oz avocados or mangoes, 79 cents a piece with that coupon. No coupon needed for plum tomatoes or jalapeno peppers at $1.29 a pound. Well, there is another digital coupon, this one for Sargento shredded or Cabot shredded or chunk cheese. With that coupon, 2 for $4. Goya beans, they're 4 cans for $5. You don't need a coupon. Cheat cheese, tortillas or salsa, $1.99 a piece. Old El Paso dinner kits are $3.49.